Joining us in studio from the AmeriAstronomy Center at the University of Maine, Sean Latch is back with us. Welcome back as fall hits us fully.
Yeah, today, of course, the big anniversary of the original launch of Sputnik. So today is actually the dawn of the space age, as they say, back in 1957. Hard to believe. They launched a little 23-inch diameter satellite, the first human-made object in space, and that sort of launched where we are today in many ways.
Yeah, because of how it impacted America and set off, a bit of a panic that the Russians were ahead of us in this. And the good news of that is that it really pushed us to advance our space program, but also increased our efforts to make sure people were educated, particularly in the areas of science and mathematics.
Yeah, it definitely did. It launched a whole revolution in the way we do education, and it's still moving forward today. And in fact, a lot of the things around STEM really are looking at that even in more depth now.
As we've talked about this before with you, because of the cost of space exploration, we've come a long way from being competitive. And now we not only cooperate, but we need that cooperation with other nations.
Yeah. I mean, right now, the way most space exploration is done is, of course, with global cooperations, whether it be the International Space Station in terms of human exploration, or whether it be missions to, the planets and beyond, where, again, it's often multiple nations that go in and build different pieces or parts of a robotic spacecraft as well. So it's definitely an international game. And I think that's good for, for the world as a whole. Hopefully it brings people together, which is a better way of going about things than pushing them apart.
Absolutely.
One would hope.
We recognized the anniversary. I think it was the Wally Schirra, the Sigma 7 mission in 1962. And I think next week is the anniversary of the first successful manned Apollo flight that also had Wally Schirra on board. I was such a fan of space exploration as a kid. Do you remember the first space mission that you were aware of as a youngster?
Yeah, probably my first one was Viking landing on Mars in 76. So I missed the Apollo bit because I was born in 70, so didn't quite.
Kids.
Yeah, I know, terrible. But I do remember Viking landing on Mars, and that was huge. It was one of the things that got me excited about space. And shortly after that, of course, Carl Sagan's Cosmos series was, really all the rage at the time and really got me going as well, along with Star Wars movies and the science fiction, which also blended in there. So, but all those things came together.
Yeah. Cosmos. And I loved Neil deGrasse Tyson's take on it as well. But to me, there's still nothing like going back and rewatching the original.
Yeah, Sagan had a particular way of stating things, I think, that was just so poetic and very touching and moving in a different way. So they definitely have distinctive styles. I grew up with Cosmos, so I'm the Carl Sagan one. So I'm very partial to that one just because of it.
Well, with the month of October here, lots of great programs taking place up at AmeriAstronomy Center, and a lot of them centered around Halloween, of course, and the celestial origins of that day. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so our Friday night public show, which starts tomorrow for this month, is Halloween Celestial Origins, and it takes a look at sort of the way Halloween started. And there's a variety of cross-quarter days, which are days most people are very familiar with, solstices and equinoxes as the starts of the season. But long ago, people would celebrate quite a few of these cross-quarter days, which are sort of days in between. And Halloween, also All Saints Day, sort of is one of those cross-quarter days, you might say, that marks sort of a midpoint between the autumn equinox or fall equinox and the winter solstice. And so there are a variety of celebrations around that and commemorations around that. And so we look at this and look at sort of the, some of the Celtic origins of course, Halloween and a variety of other traditions that go into that based on celestial objects as well and some of their celestial alignments. And then we look at some of the sort of lighter side of it, things like, supernova relating to, sort of the deaths of stars and things like that and some of those remnants in sort of a fun way and have an astronomical spin on it as well.
Very cool. That Friday night program every Friday night starting tomorrow at 7 o'clock. And also you've got a lot of things going on this afternoon, but some great programs for youngsters taking place tomorrow.
Yeah, we have today and tomorrow actually, because of the anniversaries we've been celebrating with a variety of different programming. And tomorrow we have four programs. We start off in the morning with our show Polaris and Mystery of the Polar Night at 10. And that takes a look at looking at polar length of day and night and how that changes if you're north or south on planet Earth, along with polar ice. Cosmic Colors, which looks at how we use light and color to figure out things in our universe. And then Little Star That Could, that looks at life cycles of stars, and Dream to Fly at 3 o'clock, which is a general audience show and really looks at the history of flight from hot air balloons all the way through modern space aviation. So it's definitely a fun program as well.
That's great. Sean Lash from Amera Astronomy Center here with us in studio. And, of course, Sundays are always great programming in the afternoon. Legends of the Night Sky starting up this weekend, talking about Perseus and Andromeda.
Yeah, it's a great cartoon program that is for younger children. But it takes a look at the classic story of Perseus and Andromeda, which involves Medusa. So it definitely has a Halloween feeling to it as well, where, you know, Perseus has to slay Medusa, the evil witch who could turn you into stone by looking at her in the eyes, and go through that story and find out all about it and how he saved Andromeda from her fate. And it's a fun show that takes a look at the constellations, which are all in the fall sky, of course, too. So it's a really nice tie-in. And then we start back up with our science lecture series this month in October. So October 18th, we have Justin Lapp, who is a new professor at UMaine. He'll be talking about solar energy, and not the type of solar energy we think of in terms of voltaic cells on top of your house, but this is heat energy from the sun and how they're looking at it for industrial applications. And basically, you know, every 108 minutes, we get as much energy from the sun as we use in 1 year here on Earth in terms of total human energy consumption. So there's a variety of ways that folks are looking at that, and how could we use some of that energy to do industrial applications, which would really benefit us in a variety of ways.
You're also partnering with the good people at the Maine Discovery Museum for some very cool field trip opportunities.
Yeah, we've launched a partnership with them this fall where you can come to both facilities, and we have a variety of programming depending on what age range you're looking for elementary students. And it's a great way because typically the most expensive parts of field trips are the buses and getting students places. So if we can't, you know, so we decide to partner together, and this way hopefully they get a bus and they can get dual use out of it and visit both sites. And we've had a partnership like that going on with Challenger Center for the last 2 years. It's been very successful. Challenger typically reaches more middle and high school students. So with the Maine Discovery Museum, we're able to reach those elementary students in that same way, which we're really excited about.
Absolutely. I've got a little guy at home, 4.5 years old, and he's begun to really take an interest in what's out there in the night sky. We were looking a few weeks back, and it was a beautiful, clear night. And now, I hope I'm not wrong. If I'm wrong, don't tell my little boy, okay? But I think we had a pretty good view of Jupiter and also Mars in the evening sky. Are those the stars we're likely to see this time of year?
Well, right now, I mean, it changes all the time depending on where their positions are. But right now, after sunset, you have Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn all in their night sky. Mars is sort of in the south, southeast right now and very bright and red. Jupiter is over in the southwest, low on the horizon. You only have it for about an hour, hour and a half after sunset. And Saturn is sort of in between the two. So right now, it's been a great time for planets. In particular, on Friday nights after our public show, when the weather cooperates, we do open up the observatory, and we've been showing folks Saturn because it's just really spectacular. And Mars is too, of course, but Saturn, the first time people see the rings of Saturn through a telescope is always an eye-opening thing for them, literally and figuratively, because they're like, oh, that. It's really how it looks. It's like, yes, it really is how it looks, but it is something to actually see it for the first time, you know, through a telescope. Oh, yeah. And people really enjoy that.
That's wonderful. And any celestial events of note that are coming up here later in the fall?
Well, typically, we have the Orionid meteor shower, which is later this month, and you'll get usually a fair number of meteors. It's not as good as the Perseids, but it is worth checking out if you have time. And typically that's towards the end of the month, and you'll see somewhere around 20 or so meteors an hour. It is a little bit better later in the evening, so it is sort of a late night, early morning type of event. So you're probably looking at somewhere between midnight and 2 being the best time for those. But in addition to that, there's been a lot of discoveries lately, of course.
Yeah.
One that was kind of funny that was announced just a couple days ago was this goblin planet. And which is kind of an interesting thing. They've discovered another planet out in our solar system. It's really a dwarf planet, if you're being technically correct about it. It's about 300 kilometers in size, so about a sixth the size of Pluto, so it's tiny. but it has a really elliptical orbit, almost cometary. It's at its closest approach, it's about roughly 65 astronomical units from the Sun, which is still quite a ways distant from Pluto, but at its farthest, it's about 2,300 astronomical units from the Sun. So it is a 40,000-year orbit. Wow. Pluto orbits about 248 years. So give you an idea, it's a really one of these things. And they discovered it in October of 2015, and they've had to watch it to now to actually verify the orbit and, you know, for a couple of years to see the orbital path and trajectory. So that's one that was announced. And then yesterday, there was another announcement of the first exomoon. So we've known about exoplanets, and there've been a lot of discoveries of exoplanets over the last several years. But yesterday, the first discovery of a moon going around one of these exoplanets. And it's about the size of Neptune. So it's a very large moon going around a planet that's twice the size or has twice the mass of Jupiter. So these are very large objects. But again, it's very difficult to detect planets around other stars, but even more difficult to try and find a moon. And this is the first one. So it's a pretty exciting discovery as well. So lots going on in the astronomy world right now.
I saw a story a couple of days ago that we dodged another bullet with an asteroid that might have relieved us of some of our problems, but it's amazing when you look into it. We think of these things from the movie, interpretations of them, but asteroids, they're whizzing by us all the time.
Yeah, we typically have, you know, several passes that, you know, go by us in a year. Most of them are not too close to really do damage, and, you know, most of them are very tiny and won't. But NASA does try to keep track of them, and they have a system that's monitoring and trying to detect these down to, you know, roughly 40 meters in size, because those are considered, you know, potentially serious.
Potentially.
Yeah, well, you know, they have to actually impact the Earth to be, you know, so there's a lot of things out there. You know, there's about 8,000 that we know of that, you know, are what we call near Earth approaching.
A friend of mine got some great pictures this summer down at MDI of the Milky Way. And they've got the advantage there. Is that one of the best areas around here, at least, to avoid light pollution and get to really see the night sky?
Yeah, any place you can get away from the lights, whether it be out, you know, even at Acadia or Mount Katahdin, any of those places, you get out where there's no lights. And Maine is really good. We do have a really good view of the night sky because we don't have as much light pollution. And summer is the best time of year to see the Milky Way from our vantage point because we're looking in towards the center. Whereas in winter, we're looking out towards the edge, so it's much brighter in summer. So, yeah, it's a great time to get out when you're doing your camping and take a look up.
Fantastic. Sean, always fun to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Go visit the AmeriAstronomy Center. Great programs all month long up at the University of Maine.